of a mess that God warned him about, that he shouldn't do, shouldn't go there. He went ahead and went there, but you'll see that God is still with him. He never leaves us, forsakes us, and he guides him even through this mess that he's in. And let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand your words. I do ask that you'd help us to know how we can apply the behavior that Paul demonstrated here, know how to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, and help us to see what's going on here. And I pray you'd help us to be faithful to your words. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, Paul was told three or four times by his friends, under the guidance of the Spirit of God, not to go to Jerusalem. Okay, but he went. From our perspective, we see the record, the account, that it was definitely advice given from God. But from his perspective, how do you verify that somebody's giving you advice from God? You know, like, oh, don't go to that area. How do you verify that? Really, you can't. Okay, if you get two or three giving you advice, you better pay attention to it. Okay, I've noticed through the years that if there's a topic or subject that it seems that the Lord is leading me to study, I'll get at least two sources or two different sources that may bring up that topic, and sometimes three. And that's kind of like, well, I take that as, okay, I better look at that topic because I've gotten those three witnesses. Okay, but he had three or four that told him, don't go to Jerusalem. He went. In chapter 22, he is giving his testimony. And remember that the people listened to him until he said the magical word, Gentiles. Okay, and in chapter 3, he is now in front of the religious leaders of his day. Okay, so they're going to question him. And I remember years ago, you remember back in the day, like Martin Luther and some of them old priests that came out of the Catholic Church, and then they were called to testify in front of these religious courts. I would just probably, if I were them, knowing what I know today, of course back then it's different, I'd send them a note by basically saying, go take a hike. Why would you go knowing that first off, they're biased? They're going to run the rules. They're going to make the decree. They're going to arrest you. They're going to burn you at the stake. I'd say, take off. Take a hike. What gives them the authority? There's no law being broken. They don't have authority over me. And so why pay attention to these people? A lot of times people try to answer charges that you don't need to answer these charges. And in Acts 23, Paul is going to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove, and he is going to divide these two factions that are meeting together against him. They are two factions that don't like each other, don't agree with each other, a Pharisee and a Sadducee, in a political world, Democrat, Republican, okay, but they have a common enemy in Paul. And so what he's going to do, he's going to side with one of the side, and then they're going to get in a fight with each other, and then he's going to get out of the mess, at least temporarily. So Acts 23, Paul is going to testify. Paul earnestly beholding the council. Okay, that word, how it's spelled, C-O-U-N-C-I-L, in the Bible is generally a group of people who are trying to suppress the truth. Generally, that's what that is. That if you just run that word throughout the New Testament, that's what that word is. You'll have a town council, a student council, the Nicene Council, the Vatican II Council. That's how they all spell it. And it's not really a good word as far as the Bible pattern goes. And of course, in this context, it again is a group of two separate factions that's trying to suppress the truth. So Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. Can you say that? That's quite an admission. From his testimony, that's quite a testimony. I've lived in a good conscience. Does that mean that he's never violated his conscience? No, he violated his conscience, okay, in Acts chapter 8 when he watched Stephen being stoned, or Acts 7 when he watched Stephen being stoned, and then in Acts 9, the Lord appeared to him and says, "Hard for thee to kick against the pricks of thy conscience." You know, he got under conviction about that. But a good conscience is somebody who yields to the conviction that we have. Okay, the Bible talks about a seared conscience, talks about a pure conscience. Part of the homeschool group we were a part of, they talked about a clear conscience. I've learned through time a clear conscience, somebody's got a bad memory. Okay, a pure conscience is different. A good conscience is different. Okay, now any of us will recognize this experience. When you know you're doing something wrong, your conscience will convict you of that wrong. Now, the limitation of our conscience, it doesn't tell us what's right to do, but our conscience will tell us what we're doing is not right. We as parents know that when our children are very quiet around the house, they're probably up to something. Okay, and so that's our conscience. Now, if we yield to that conscience, it's a good conscience. But if we don't yield, if we justify ourselves, the second time we commit that act, our conscience is weakened a little more. And then the third time, and then the fourth time, and then the fifth time, if we don't correct that behavior, our conscience becomes seared or calloused. The first couple times it's like a blister. The second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh time, as we get more, then our conscience becomes calloused and seared, and then we are justifying ourselves. And that's why Paul says you got to have a good conscience. This is what he told Timothy, to have a pure conscience. Okay, a child, maybe when they get up in their teenage years, have done something that they know their parents wouldn't want them to know about. Their conscience is the one alerting them of that. Samson did this. When you read the book of the Judges, where it says that he did several things that he did not want his parents to know about. Why? It was his conscience. And then you follow Samson's pattern in his life and you'll see a pretty rough situation. Okay, and so we want to try to keep our conscience good, pure. Pure is best. Okay, but there's going to be times we're going to violate it. Okay, and the thing is fess up and get it right. Okay, and so Paul said, I've lived in a good conscience before God unto this day. And so when he was under conviction about watching Stephen being martyred, if he did not get saved in Acts 9, where it cleans up your conscience more, then Saul would have continued to justify, and he would have fulfilled John 16, verse 2, where it says that he would kill the Jews believing that he's doing God's service. Okay, and this is a pattern, no matter what religious background people come up with, okay, come up through. Okay, it doesn't matter. The conscience will alert them of the hypocrisies in their faith somewhere when it shows up. What are they going to do with that conscience? Are they going to try to seek out the truth, or are they going to just justify it? Then they will continue down that path and sear their conscience. Okay, Freeman just sent me probably it was a test flight for some Muslims. Did anybody send you this from Freeman? Ron, did you see that? Where about 11 Muslims got on this airplane, two or three in the front in first class, two or three way in the back, two or three in the middle. And the ones were making a big scene before the plane took off, and the one was laughing about pornography. I mean, is that loud in the Quran? You know, their conscience would tell them that's wrong. But they're making a big scene, and the stewardess is, you know, not knowing how to deal with this, is trying to deal with it, and they told her, "You infidel, get out of my face." Okay, and then a couple Texans stood up and helped the stewardess. Then they kicked the Muslims off the plane, the TSA. Searched them, found nothing, put them back on the plane. Okay, and then the stewardess says, "I'm not flying on this plane." And her and the whole crew got off. Here comes a new flight crew. Muslims still on the plane. The Texans say, "We're not flying on this plane." He said, "Once you're on this plane, you ain't getting off." And he said, "Watch me." And he got off. And the other Texan gets off, and a bunch of people gets off. And so now they have to cancel the flight. Was that a test? Probably. How are they going to respond to these Muslims throwing a fit? What are they going to do? Okay, and that's a masterful plan. I've heard this plan work very good if you go to a meeting. If it's a large meeting of people, four or five people can overtake the meeting very quickly. And how you do it is you have one guy sit in the front, one guy in the back, and two on the sides. And then when time's for questions, one guy in the front stands up and he asks a very convicting question, exposes the one. And if he answers it or don't answer, one in the back stands up and answers the same or a follow-up question. And the psychological makeup of the people are one's in front, one's in back, and then one on the side. And they say, "We're surrounded," and it's only four guys. And they were going to try to take over a plane with what? 11 guys. In the front, in the middle, in the back. Okay, and a believer should know these things. And so if we want to go to a meeting to expose a political candidate, if four or five get together and you set it out, you could really have an enjoyable time. But you got to pretend you don't know each other. You know, we used to do this in the court things where we'd go try to stack the court audience. And I didn't know that when you sit in the front seat in a courtroom, that's usually reserved for attorneys. And so two fellows and I, we went in, we sat right in the front, and it was going to be delayed. And a clerk came up to us, we were sitting in the front, was going to give us a knowledge that it's going to be delayed. Attorneys, not anybody else, just us two. And they said, "Are you attorneys?" And my friend sitting next to me said, "No." I said, "Speak for yourself." I wasn't going to give it up. "Well, we just want to let you know that it's been delayed." "Well, I appreciate it very much so." Okay, but that's a way of influence. You know, isn't it amazing how few people influence our culture and the world through the news industry? And that's why it's called a media, as in a medium, as in changing their minds. Okay, and so Paul said, "I'm living in a good conscience." Now, if a Muslim is living in a good conscience, trying to obey the Quran and the imams, and when they start noticing these hypocrisies, and Muhammad didn't even follow the Quran, they're going to start thinking if their conscience is good. And they're going to start thinking, and they'll probably start searching, and then God will be looking at that heart, and he'll send either some literature, okay, because some of these places you can't get a missionary to them, so he'll somehow get literature there, or he might get a person there, and if none of that is allowed or capable, God just might send an angel that they think it's a person. It's an amazing thing what the Lord can do when he wants to get his message out. There's a fellow that studied the ocean currents down in Florida, and he threw bottles in the water with tracks, and he thought that he had it figured out that it would float to Cuba. And so he'd get out in the ocean, he'd say, "If I drop them all here, these bottles will get to Cuba, and that's great, man, I'll be excited." And so he thought he had it all figured out, and then he just got a little impatient. He got, "I want to do more than that." So he flew an airplane over Cuba and dumped out a bunch of tracks. And his plane went down in Cuba. And boy, that's a rough situation. Guy's name was Tom White, and while he's in jail in Cuba, a guy said, "Can you believe it? I found this piece of paper in a bottle on the beach." And that confirmed to him that his thing was right. And eventually, there was a political exchange, a prisoner exchange, under the Jimmy Carter administration, and this guy got out of Cuba, amazingly. Okay, but that's how God can get his information out, as he chooses. He works best behind the scenes. There's a book in the Bible that the scholars say shouldn't be in there. And the reason why they say it shouldn't be in the Bible, because it doesn't use the word God or Lord in the entire book. And that's Esther. Okay, the book of Esther doesn't use the name Lord or God, so our scholars say it shouldn't be in the Bible. And Esther shows how God works behind the scenes more than any book in the Bible. It's just that they don't see that. Okay, and the reason why God does is because he doesn't have us to get in the way. Okay, so Paul lived in a good conscience, and we need to have a good conscience. There's so many passages I got there on conscience. Again, the limitation of our conscience is it doesn't tell us what's right to do. And a person's conscience can be seared, and it can be perverted somehow. Okay, what I mean by that is a Catholic can have a conscience that bothers them when somebody gives them a gospel tract. Now, that's a conscience that's been manipulated. Okay, and so our conscience is something that we need to keep a good conscience, okay, and yield and ask God to guide us when our conscience is convicting us. Okay, in verse 2, the high priest Ananias, same character that was involved in a crucifixion, commanded them that stood by him to smite him in the mouth. Punch that guy in the mouth. And they did. Then said Paul unto him, "God shall smite thee, thou whited wall." Okay, now if somebody calls me a whited wall in our culture, it's like, "Oh, don't hurt me so bad." Well, I got some pain on my face. I don't know. In that culture, it must be bad. Okay, for us, what's the big deal? Okay, but it must be bad. He says, "Thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" So he's pointing out the hypocrisy of Ananias. And the guy is a hypocrite. And they that stood by said, "Revilest thou God's high priest?" Oh, you can't do that. Why can't you do that? Well, it's his office. So what? He doesn't warrant the respect in his office. A lot of people say, well, you know, if you go to a church and a pastor, you should respect the pastor. Do you say that to a Roman Catholic priest that 50% are, you know, Now, I'm not saying we should be disrespectful to anybody. Okay, but just because a guy's in the office doesn't mean that I, who am maybe his same age or a touch older than him, have to treat him with vast respect and honor. In 1 Thessalonians, it says you respect a man for his work's sake. Okay, but yet, if he's of my caliber, equal, you know, as far as another pastor, if he needs to be rebuked by God, he needs to be rebuked. Okay, but again, okay, Paul sees the situation. You have a bunch of people that sees this guy, and this guy can do no wrong. And I got to deal with these people? You see, in courtroom settings, truth often doesn't matter. It don't matter at all in many cases. And in fact, the ones who sincerely and honestly try to give forth the truth in court settings usually don't matter. It's the ones who give an appearance of truth that the court wants to hear. They're the ones that get the court to rule on their side. And that's a sad fact of life. Paul knew that fact, and you're going to see that Paul understood that, and then he acted accordingly. Okay, there's a young man in Colorado Springs that Christian school there, and he had to take the SAT test. And he said, now, if I'm going to answer those questions on that test the way I know is true, I ain't passing this test. So I'm going to answer it according to what they think is true. Now, that's wise. If you're required to take that test, you got to think their mindset. Okay, and Paul is going to change to their mindset. Okay, so he says, revilest thou God's high priest? Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest. Oh, come on, Paul. You had to know. I mean, the guy's sitting in a prominent place. He's got a certain outfit. He would have had to know that. But, okay, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. Now, he didn't quote it exactly. Okay, but still, I don't know if, here's an example. Okay, he didn't quote that exactly, but that's what he quoted. And the Bible gives an inspired statement of what he quoted. Okay, but even at that, he said, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. But when Paul perceived, now he's noticing what's going on. When Paul perceived that one part was Sadducees and the other part's Pharisees, he cried out in the council. He just yelled, blurted this out. Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. Now, if we remember the story, is that statement true? It is not true. Paul's making something up. He is dividing to conquer, is what he's doing. He's dividing these two. The Sadducees didn't believe in that. He's a Pharisee. Now they're going to start fighting. They're getting off the issue. Okay, this is what the news media often does. They get off the real issue and they get on an emotional charged issue. Something that society thinks is emotional and so important, and you sure aren't even worthy to live. And that's what the news media is masters of. Why was Paul called into question? We go back and we research it, we look at it, and we see that Paul was called in question because he brought Gentiles in the Jewish temple back in chapter 21. And in chapter 22, he said that magical word in front of the Jews, Gentiles. And so he is dividing these people to conquer them. You say he lied. Probably so. Yeah. Just like Rahab lied about the two witnesses. You say, well, you know, I don't think that's right. Depends on the situation. In Rahab's time, it was a matter of warfare. She had a choice of telling the truth and allowing two Jews get murdered, or lie and allow 500 sex perverts in Jericho get killed. She picked the lesser of two evils. And what did God do? He honored her for lying to the mayor or the king of Jericho. He honored her. What did he do to the midwives when they were told by Pharaoh to kill those baby Jewish boys? And they said, them Hebrew women, boy, they're lively. They have a kid and they're out of there. We don't have time to kill the kid. They lied to Pharaoh. And what did God do? God blessed them. There are times that you and I don't need to answer people's questions. Don't feel obligated to answer their questions. Okay? And that's in a situation, okay, that a person needs to realize the situation and ask God for wisdom. And Jesus said, be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. Okay, and a lot of times that's dealing with somebody that has a badge and a gun and a nightstick and a taser when they ask a question. You don't need to answer their questions. You say, well, I want to be honest. And they'll turn your honesty against you in many places. Okay, and a person has to be wise. You say, what's the answer? The answer is that is of no consequence. What is your name? My name is of no consequence. Is that your name? My name is of no consequence. Deal with it what you got to do. What is your name? I don't have first-hand knowledge of that. Well, what were your name when you were born? I don't know. I was very little. I don't remember that day. Probably the first thing I remember is getting stuck in a corner in kindergarten. That's about the first recollection I really have in life. In a Presbyterian rangeline church, was probably too ambitious or something, too much energy, and she stuck me in a corner in kindergarten. Back in those days, churches had kindergartens with the public school. They didn't have issues of separation church and state. And another kid got stuck in a corner, he started crying, and we thought it was so funny. Big baby, you get stuck in a corner, you cry about it. Should get used to that. Okay, but no, you don't have to answer these questions. When somebody asks you, a public official, police officer asks you a question, why do they want you to answer it? Because that's an admission. And it saves their job. Saves them some time. You can be polite and kind and just say, it's like one fellow was going, he got deposed. The guy that taught me and taught several of us law classes, he got deposed for 2 days. And his answer was, I'll take the Fifth Amendment. The answer was, I'll take the Fifth. The answer was, I'll take the Fifth. Are you going to answer the Fifth for everything? Well, I don't know all the questions, so I can't. I didn't take the Fifth. So the answer is no. If he would have said yes, then they could have put him for contempt. You don't know all the answers. Okay, and so in this case, as in Martin Luther's day, as in some of those days where the Catholic Church called them into question, why waste the time to go to those guys? They felt compelled to. Okay, where, I don't know, maybe they wanted a martyr's crown. They didn't think of it any differently. In Paul's case, he was, these people have no authority over me. They have no right for me to be here. I don't need to be here. They're wasting my time. I think I'm going to have a little fun and divide them. And so he said, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope of the resurrection. I've been called in question. No, you didn't, Paul. Come on. You're just playing around with these guys, messing with their brain. And it worked for the short time. Verse 7, and when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. And that's the class warfare that politicians play. The people don't get together and say that this parasite cannot survive without us. We need to boot this parasite out and get rid of the job. They don't think that way. But these people who have multi-million dollar bank accounts are trying to equate themselves with the common people of today. Go kid somebody else. Okay, so Paul has divided them. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say that there's no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Now, why didn't they say that on the crucifixion day? It's because the Lord Jesus said nothing. The Lord Jesus Christ could have talked his way out of that trial. He was innocent. Remember what he did? He remained silent. And it was so surprising to Herod and Pilate that, don't you know I could crucify you? And then the Lord just said, you'd have no power of all. You would have no power at all except my Father give it to you. And that shocked them. The Lord could have outsmarted them, obviously, right? But he had a purpose. In this case, these guys said, we better not fight against God. Well, you sure did at the crucifixion. They're trying to save face now. This is one of ours. Verse 10, and when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded his soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and to bring him into the castle. And the night following, the Lord stood by him. Isn't that wonderful that even though Paul disobeyed orders from God, which maybe he didn't know if they were specifically from God, but yet he disobeyed orders from God, and there the Lord is right with him. He's right with him. The Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. He said, I'm going with you. I'm going with you. And so that was one thing the Lord had him do. Verse 12, and when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. I wonder how long that lasted. And there were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. Okay, what is a conspiracy? Okay, conspiracy theories. No, there's no such thing as conspiracy theories per se. The Bible is a book that is loaded with conspiracy facts. Okay, to talk about a conspiracy is how Rush Limbaugh will hang up on you. Make fun of you. A conspiracy is nothing more than two or more people agreeing to commit an unlawful act. And he don't believe there's more than two people that want to commit an unlawful act against this country? Are you kidding me? There's 13 families in Illuminati that wants to commit unlawful acts to this country. The Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, you mentioned those magical words, the Rushbow, and he will mock you and laugh at you and hang up on you, just like that. I mean, the Bible and Jeremiah believe conspiracies were realities. Okay, and so here's 40 guys banded together. We're not going to eat or drink. We want to kill Paul. 14, and they came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. So God heard that, obviously. And God is going to get what he wants you and I to know to us in any way, fashion. However he wants it done. Now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him, and we or ever he come near are ready to kill him. So they're finagling this. And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait. Now here is God behind the scenes. Paul's nephew heard him talking. How did he hear this? Who knows? He went and entered into the castle and told Paul. He went right to Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him. Now evidently Paul had a relationship, a good rapport with the centurion. Why would a centurion want to do that? If this centurion has the mindset of a lot of jailers, you scumbag, you're in jail, you're a scumbag, you're not worthy to be here, so just shut up and get out of my face. Well, in this case, the centurion said, okay, gotcha, get it done. 18, so he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me, that's ask, prayed me, to bring this young man unto thee who hath something to say unto thee. Then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, what is it that thou hast to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, For there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, looking for a promise from thee. So the chief captain then let the young man depart, charged him, see thou tell no man that thou hast showed me these things to me. And he called him, and he called unto him two centurions, saying, make ready 200 soldiers. So there is the Bible giving us the record that a centurion is a man who has 100 soldiers under them. And in this case, you've got two of them, so 200 soldiers under them. That means that Cornelius had 100 soldiers that he trained. And he said, make ready 200 soldiers to go into Caesarea, horsemen 70, spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night. So at midnight, beginning at midnight, first hour 6 o'clock, second hour 9 o'clock, or the third watch. Okay, in this case, third hour of the night. So third hour of the night, that'd be 9 o'clock at night. Okay, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter after this manner, Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued. Notice how this guy's really puffing this up. Typical bureaucrat. I'm the hero. You know, he said, I took an army. Came with an army and rescued him. How about the young fellow that told you about this? Why didn't he just say, a young fellow told me about a conspiracy, and I told these guys, no, he's a typical bureaucrat. Got to make himself the hero. He says, having understood that he was a Roman, and when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to this charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when it was told me how the Jews laid wait for the man, I went straightway to thee and gave commandment to his accusers also to say unto thee, before thee, what they had said against him, farewell. Okay, so he's just trying to be the hero, but again, we're glad he did it. 31, then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with them and returned to the castle, who when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was, and when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear thee, said he. And that was jurisdiction. I will hear thee, said he, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Okay, that's just a pretty clear narrative what's going on there. But in verse 33, I want to point out something in 34. Okay, at the beginning of Paul's letters, every one of his letters, you'll read the title, The Epistle of Paul, the Apostle to the Romans. Okay, what's epistle mean? Acts 23, verse 33, he delivered the epistle. Acts 23:34, and when the governor had read the letter. So you can circle letter, circle epistle, put a line to them, and that's the Bible definition. And that's how the Bible defines its terms. That one is just an easy one, two verses apart. Many of the definitions of the Bible are just like that, where you can find it in the passage itself, or close to the passage. So now we know what epistle means. Why didn't he use the word letter? It's because epistle is a more of a legal term. And the Bible is a legal book. And so that's how Paul writes it. Okay, so that's chapter 23. Any questions or comments? What we covered?